Hey folks, welcome to the Hang Your Own Hang podcast, a monthly podcast about hammocks, hammock camping, and of course, everything related. Our goal is to enlighten you if you're a ground dweller and to entertain you if you're already a tree dweller. I'm Jonathan Kupel, and of course, we have here my co-host Mark Baldwin.
Evening, Jonathan. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Just, you know, busy fall.
Yeah.
always is. Kids.
Yeah, of course. I had a chance to go scouting last weekend and tried out my new Dutch tarp. What was it? The tarp worms.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I saw that in the last order that you got.
Yeah. They're pretty cool. I kind of have to like rethink how I've got my stakes done and stuff like that. But what I'm really trying to do is not have a chance to like lose my tent stakes. So if everything is kind of connected, I'm thinking it all hold together a little better.
Yeah. It does help out. That's why I actually have my tie outs on my stake with the fleas right on the tarp, so a little more visibility on the stake, so you try not to forget them.
Yep. One less thing to lose.
Yep.
Cool. Well, this week's interview should be a really interesting interview. We've got Ben Lawton from the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics.
Yeah, it should be interesting. I know there's a lot of things going on the different forums and all about, especially with hanging, where you can hang and what discussions with park rangers and all about the Leave No Trace with hammocks and all.
Yeah, that's true. And even with a lot of the conversations we have within scouting now, Leave No Trace and outdoor ethics are becoming more important as a way to express your concern for the environment. So I think it's timely. It's about time we had a serious conversation about how you're leaving the environment when you're using it.
Yep, that's definitely important.
On to the interview. All right, so for today's episode, we've got a special guest, Ben Lawton, the education director from the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and spend some time with you all.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was doing a little bit of research. You definitely seem to have the qualifications for talking about Leave No Trace and talking about the outdoors. You have an undergraduate degree in natural resource management.
And then, correct.
What does that mean, actually? I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, great question. I did my undergraduate work at the University of Tennessee and with a specific focus in natural resource management. And we looked at the suite of different types of renewable resources in most cases that you could apply some management techniques to ensure sustainability. So things like water resources, watershed management, timber resources, so, you know, forest products and that sort of thing. And so it was, for me, it was a great sort of first cut at resource management work and has really translated well into my career in that field as well as my career with Leave No Trace.
Okay, great. And then you continued with a master's degree in... It looks like your master's degree is in human dimensions of natural resource. I understand that it seems like it would be a natural progression from what you did in your undergraduate.
Correct. In some ways it is. The unique thing about the human dimensions of natural resources is it is, I like to think of it as the social side or the human side of managing natural resources. It's really sort of the exploration of how we as either individuals or even at the community level interact with our natural resources, the resources that we're surrounded with. So in the context of Leave No Trace, we tend to explore things related to people's behavior in the outdoors, whether that's front country or back country or wilderness or even a city park. And we really look at the relationship people have to shared public spaces, public lands, for example, and it helps us in our efforts to educate people about enjoying those places responsibly and sustainably, not just for today, but for tomorrow.
Got it. Yeah, and it looks like, again, from your bio, I'm dipping a little deep here, but it looks like you enjoy the outdoors as much as the rest of us.
Yeah, you know, I certainly do. I grew up in a family. I was very fortunate. My father had the pop-up camper that we hauled behind the Chevy station wagon in the 70s. I grew up in the Southeast, and we hauled that thing all over the place. We had the aluminum Grumman canoe with the orange May West life preservers and the matching paddles, and spent my childhood roaming the hills and the woods of Tennessee, and it just translated into a lifelong love of the outdoors. And so it's certainly followed, you know, my enjoyment of the outdoors has paralleled my career, in natural resource management and really educating people about taking care of what we have.
Got it. And that segued directly into, your getting a job working for the Leave No Trace organization.
Yeah. So, you know, when I, finished my undergraduate studies at the University of Tennessee, I had been spending a lot of time on the Appalachian National Scenic Trail and just fascinated with all things having to do with the AT, and in particular, the thoughts of a through hike on the AT. And I fortunate enough to have planned and started to execute a through hike, and I hiked about 800 miles of the AT one summer and ended up with a stress fracture that, despite multiple weeks off the trail and lots of doctors and so forth, just couldn't get to heal. So came off the trail and had previously worked on a backcountry trail crew for the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, and ended up taking a job with the Appalachian Trail Conservancy in their Southern Regional Office in Asheville, North Carolina. And it was a great introduction to the outdoors in terms of a professional setting, working on the trail, working with volunteers. We basically were in charge of protecting and maintaining the Appalachian National Scenic Trail. And as part of that work, I was basically sent to a Leave No Trace course, a five-day, what's known as our Leave No Trace Master Educator course, that took place in Cajada Wilderness in Georgia. And I had known about Leave No Trace since the mid-90s, and this is in 1999. And that course really became a focal point for me, both personally and professionally, as something to aspire to do more of, to teach more people about Leave No Trace and basically, you know, common sense ways to protect our shared resources. And a few years later, a position opened with the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics in Colorado. And, you know, one thing led to another, and I applied for the job. And 4 months later, packed up everything I owned and moved, you know, 1,700 miles across the country, and have been there now for coming up on 16 years.
Okay. Oh. Yeah, that must have been scary.
It was a little daunting, but, you know, there was so much passion involved, and I had lived in Colorado previously, and it was a place I knew I wanted to eventually someday land in again. And so it was in some ways a challenging decision, but in other ways it was one of the biggest no-brainers of my life.
Have you ever hammock camped before? Do you have any experience hammock camping, or is it just regular tent camping and tarp camping?
Yeah, for me, you know, I was introduced to the outdoors in an era where, you know, tent camping was the thing to do. And that sort of followed me through my kind of adult life, and have done lots and lots of nights under tarp, just given the lightweight aspects and the flexibility, lots and lots of nights in the tent. I own two hammocks that I routinely use, but I have to say, I have to admit, I have not actually spent the night in a hammock. And I attribute part of that of most of my trips now with my family. And I've got a 10-year-old son who is an avid budding outdoorsman. And maybe some point I'll get the entire family in hammocks. But for now, we're still tent bound. But I will say, the hammocks are great for our family. Particularly, we do a lot of long-distance rafting trips, multi-day, 6-7 day self-supported long raft trips in places like Idaho. Oh, nice. And Utah, and you know, the other western states. And the hammocks are a staple in our river gear because they're just so enjoyable at river campsites. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to have a layover day on a beautiful river in the middle of nowhere and to be just sort of swinging in the breeze in a hammock reading a great book. It's so I certainly I'm familiar with hammocks. In my job at Leave No Trace, I deal with hammock camping quite a bit in terms of educating people that are really into it. And I work with a lot of the hammock manufacturers around the country in terms of their educational efforts, their clientele and their customer base. So certainly a topic I'm familiar with, but I've yet to take the plunge myself.
All right. Well, maybe by the end of the show, we'll have you convinced.
There you go. There you go.
I know. Anecdotally, I've heard, I've got some friends who do some camping up in the Algonquins in upper Ontario, and they said it's certainly easier to find a campsite, especially in that kind of a forest area with a hammock than it is to do it with a tent. So we'll convince you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, clearly there are lots of advantages to hammock camping, in particular as it pertains to minimizing your impact. And we can certainly discuss those things in more detail as we go along here.
Okay, great.
Great. Yeah, Ben, starting off with, look, you know, with the Leave No Trace organization, they seem to base their ideas on 7 basic principles. You know, can you care to touch on those real quick, or maybe just
sure.
basically what they are?
Yeah, sure. So we like to think of sort of the foundation of Leave No Trace as these 7 principles. And they're when you hear the 7 principles or read the 7 principles, fairly common sense information. Obviously, like so many things in life, there's tends to be more to it than meets the eye. But the 7 principles are: plan ahead and prepare, travel and camp on durable surfaces, dispose of waste properly, leave what you find, minimize campfire impacts, respect wildlife, and be considerate of other visitors. And these 7 principles really are sort of the bedrock of the Leave No Trace program and ultimately the foundation of this outdoor ethic that we are trying to share with folks who enjoy and ultimately care about the outdoors. And those 7 principles are unique because they are broadly applicable to nearly any environment, any ecosystem, any outdoor pursuit, whether you are hammock camping the entire length of the Appalachian Trail or you are laying on your back in your local city park watching the clouds go by. And that's the beautiful thing about Leave No Trace, is it's just very adaptable to virtually anywhere that people spend time in the outdoors.
Interesting. Now, actually, going on how you're saying how you can adapt anywhere, can you explain more or the differences between backcountry and front country? I think front country is not something that a lot of people hear of. Everybody hears, you know, backcountry out in the wilderness and all. If you can differentiate between the two.
Yeah, sure. Great question. So just to give you a snapshot of the history of Leave No Trace, which will lead to my answer to your question about the distinction of front country and back country. Leave No Trace as an idea, as a philosophy, if you will, really started and was more or less born out of the passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964. When that act was passed, there was an increase in recreation and visitation to public lands. And part of that act was to connect Americans with their public lands and encourage people to visit these incredible places that are, very forward-thinking politicians and conservationists at the time had set aside as places that are untrammeled by man, and man is a visitor and does not remain. And what we started to see, what land managers started to see as we moved into the 1970s, was an increase in recreation-related impacts to these lands. And what they started to realize is it was not malicious intent. No one woke up and said, how can I go out and harm the wilderness today? It was more just a general lack of knowledge. It was just ignorance. People didn't know how to properly dispose of their human waste. They didn't know how to properly store their food from wildlife in the area. They didn't know how to build campfires that leave less impact. And as the thinking evolved in our federal land management agencies, notably the National Park Service and the USDA Forest Service, and as well as the Bureau of Land Management, we moved into the 1980s, and each of these agencies had a program really sort of addressing some of these issues of recreational impact, but there was very little national leadership or interagency cooperation. And so you had these very disparate efforts from one agency to the next. And as we moved into the late 80s and 90s, the USDA Forest Service began to use the phrase no trace camping. And some of the names you may have seen over the years were things like wilderness manners or wilderness ethics or backcountry ethics. And the Forest Service really took the lead and said, we're gonna go with this idea of no trace. And they took it one step further and said, we're actually going to call it Leave No Trace. And the original intent of the program was focused on those real backcountry and wilderness areas. And for many years, that was our primary focus, was really encouraging people to minimize their impact in these very pristine settings. And what we started to realize in the last 15 years or so is that Leave No Trace is just as applicable in other areas as it is in wilderness. And so to your question about front country as we, the center, define it, is outdoor areas that are easy to get to by car and mostly visited by day users. Now, we do lump in areas that offer developed overnight camping and developed sites, your sort of typical National Park Service or Forest Service campground, or even a pay campground, for example. And so with front country, what we tend to see when you look at visitation and outdoor recreation participation studies, we see that about 90% of all outdoor recreation in the U.S. occurs in what we call front country. So that's a huge number of people. And So as the Leave No Trace program has evolved over the years, front country visitors have become a bigger part of our audience, so to speak, because the thinking is twofold. One, if we can reach those front country visitors with Leave No Trace, great. If they then venture into more backcountry and wilderness, maybe more pristine areas, then they've already learned about Leave No Trace. So front country continues to be a very specific focus for us because that's really where the people are in many ways. And we have adapted the Leave No Trace principles for a more front country audience. They're built off those original seven principles, but they have been adapted somewhat to better resonate in most front country environments.
And then do you notice with the front country, the people that are doing the front more front country, is it harder to educate them on it if they're just some of the weekend warriors or in the fact that it seems, you know, you'd think a lot of backcountry, whether they know about the seven principles or not, they're out there, they're going to more or less going to respect nature and their surroundings and all, where front country, sometimes you may, you know, get the, you know, the real partiers or something, and it'd be a little tougher to educate them on the Leave No Trace and respecting their environment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to paint with too broad of brushstrokes,
right,
but I would say that the true hardcore backcountry visitors, the wilderness visitors, it has been my experience in the past decade and a half that there may be a higher level of awareness in terms of their Leave No Trace practices with that particular audience, as opposed to the more casual outdoor enthusiasts that may camp once or twice a year, or they may day hike once a quarter. You know, they just don't necessarily have the level of knowledge, and they haven't necessarily had the exposure. Mm-hmm. And so that presents both some very unique challenges, but it also presents a tremendous amount of opportunity, because what I have found is that for many first-time users or first-time visitors, if we can catch those people on their first few outings, regardless of how they choose to spend time outdoors, we stand a much better chance of having them internalize Leave No Trace as a concept, philosophy, as well as a technique or suite of techniques. And for them, it's just the way we spend time outside. So it's almost, in some ways, you're starting with more of a blank canvas. And it can be harder to change the minds of, and not to to disparage any one group, but I myself am an Eagle Scout, and I'm an Eagle Scout from the 80s. And I had Scout leaders that it was very challenging to change their mind because that's the way they had always done it. And so right. In my job now, I interface with people that are really learning. And in some ways, it's almost easier. And on that note, we even in our ongoing research efforts, one of our more recent studies, we analyzed backcountry visitors' attitudes and perceptions about Leave No Trace versus front country visitors' perceptions about Leave No Trace. And these were specifically visitors to national parks. And they're just not very different. We find that front country people and back country people, to segment those two groups, mm-hmm. are almost equally receptive of this idea of Leave No Trace.
Now, earlier you were mentioning about, actually it could have been before we even started recording, about a framework of an approach, you know, working up into following the complete seven principles, you know, just doing one and then another and then another. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. Leave No Trace is best thought of as a framework for making good decisions for enjoying the outdoors responsibly. It's not black or white. It's not right or wrong. Leave No Trace is not rules or regulations. It simply gives people who spend time in the outdoors a way to think about minimizing their impact. And we couple that with specific techniques, which are not hard, to minimize those impacts. You know, I like to think of the outdoors as this spectrum, right? And on one end of the spectrum, we've got areas that are really suffering from heavy recreation-related impacts. And on the other end, we've got areas with very few or maybe no impacts. And what I encourage folks to do is find their place on that spectrum. You know, doing anything to minimize your impact is better than doing nothing at all. You know, we certainly don't expect people to head out in the outdoors and do everything Leave No Trace 100% all the time. Would that be great? Sure, we'd have a lot less impact. But is that realistic? I don't think it's very realistic. What I think is more realistic is encouraging people, next time you're out with your dog, pick up after your pet, properly dispose of that waste. The next time you're out, pick up after your pet and maybe pick up a piece of trash you see on the trail. So it's thinking about, what can I do today on this particular outing to leave less trace, which I have seen over time encourages people to try to do more to leave even less of a trace on subsequent visits. So it's this progression. It's this building of helping people not only learn the skills and the techniques, but it's also helping those people in some way simultaneously developing their own personal outdoor ethic. You know, and I like to think of an ethic as what you do when nobody's watching, when you're the only person that has to make those decisions, and it's seemingly you're the only one that those decisions affect in that moment. And so it's what is the decision I'm going to make right here, right now? And if we can get people to just start thinking about the consequences of their actions on the places they visit, and we give people skills to minimize those impacts and reduce those consequences, we see how people change their attitudes over time and evolve into this stronger outdoor ethic and really start to put Leave No Trace into action.
So getting into the hammocks, how does people hammock camping, and with it becoming more and more popular, how does this fit into the principles of Leave No Trace?
You know, hammock camping really fits well into Leave No Trace. There are so many distinct advantages to hammock camping in terms of minimizing your impact. You know, when we talk about the second principle, travel and camp on durable surfaces, think about the footprint that a tent could leave, particularly if you haven't chosen a site that can withstand that impact. You know, one of the things that we encourage is find the most durable ground you can, and perhaps that's barren ground that has no existing vegetation, or it's gravel or sand or even snow. Find a durable surface that can withstand those footfalls and that tent footprint for the night or maybe a couple of nights. With hammocks, you don't have to worry about that. Another advantage to hammocks, specifically in terms of ground disturbance, is you're not putting stakes in the ground. You don't have to find a level piece of ground. If you've got two trees, you could sleep on a slanted boulder field. So it gives you so much more flexibility in terms of where you can camp. And that alone, I think in many ways, sets hammock camping apart, particularly when it's done using tree saver straps, mm-hmm. and you know, you're following local rules and regulations that the land managers may have in place. But in many ways, hammock camping takes a lot of the guesswork out of finding a suitable site and worrying about things like ground disturbance. I mean, obviously, you need to be cognizant of what's under your hammock when you step in and out of it. But generally speaking, you're minimizing those potential issues just by the very fact that you're off the ground.
Right. And then you were saying about, you know, we all know, and even when somebody says they want to get into hammock camping, the first thing they always say is, you know, if your hammock came with ropes or anything, ditch those and get tree straps to protect the trees and all. Do the ropes, do they actually do damage to the trees?
Well, you know, there's not a tremendous amount of definitive empirical data on ropes versus straps. However, there are recreation ecologists, and these are people that really study recreation-related impacts for a living. They look at how impacts are caused, what the consequences are, how they can be minimized, and what the managerial implications of those impacts are for land managers. There are some folks that have been very interested in this very issue of what kind of damage are we potentially doing to the bark and the cambium layers of trees. And it's obviously, you know, different species are perhaps more susceptible to those types of impacts. Given what we know in terms of some anecdotal, some documented evidence, tree saver straps really probably are the better bet, because there's no question that you're spreading that impact over a broader area. And look, if tree saver straps are the same weight as ropes, yet they have more upside benefit in terms of protecting the trees for sustainability of hammock camping, particularly where you've got people that maybe go to the same places and in some cases maybe utilize the same trees over and over. It's a bit of a no-brainer. It goes back to my point of anything that we can do to minimize our impact is better than doing nothing at all. So I would say yes on the tree saver straps, and I would say stay tuned for potentially some more empirical data on not only the type of damage that potentially could be caused by ropes versus straps, but also looking at things like the width of straps. You know, how wide is wide enough? Is it how wide is, you know, what's too narrow? So we are keenly aware of this as hammock camping increases, and it's something that we are very interested in and are Research colleagues on the ecology side of Leave No Trace are also interested in this.
Now, are they currently running tests or thinking of or planning anything to try and put some actual empirical data to it?
We have developed a methodology for studying this sort of thing. And I say we, myself and a researcher with the U.S. Geologic Survey, who is a longtime recreation ecologist, have sort of put our heads together on a methodology that could be employed to really get at this very issue. And not only just potentially damaging the tree, the bark, and so forth, but also what's the ground disturbance underneath hammocks? Because that's something, if we're going to study the potential damage to the bark, we might as well look at the sort of the total picture. And the thing that we are, the trick with most research is you've got to find the funding. And so we have some feelers out there, and should funding be made available, this is absolutely a topic of interest for us and certainly for the hammock camping community, as well as the manufacturers and land managers.
Yeah, actually, now when you were mentioning about the camping on the durable surfaces, that's one thing I even remember when I was an Eagle Scout as well. And when I was in Scouts, we always were in tents, and sleeping on durable surfaces, I mean, that's not comfortable, even with especially with the foam pads. And you want to find, you know, if we're in a field, you want finding the areas with the heavy grass and everything, because that's going to be a lot more comfortable, which then you're trampling the surfaces and all.
Potentially, but interestingly enough, one of the more durable surfaces out there is dry grasses. And I say dry, they could be live. We're not talking dead grass, but just wet grasses. Right. Wet ground in general tends to be very susceptible to trampling impacts and erosion and that sort of thing. But dry grasses can be a very, very durable surface and can be very, very resilient. There's actually a number of studies that have been done, trampling studies, looking at how many passes, so footfalls, how many times can you walk over grasses versus, say, broad-leafed herbaceous vegetation. Think of plants in the forest that are broad-leafed plants. And what these studies have routinely shown is that in many cases, after 250 passes over broadleaf plants, you can lose 50% of the vegetation cover, whereas on dry grasses, you might lose 5 to 10%. And so they're very durable. So again, even, you know, thinking about where you might hang a hammock, give some thought to the ground below you, but know that just by the very act of you not touching the ground at night while you're sleeping, you're minimizing your impact.
Interesting. Then for the tree straps, it says recommendations have changed over time, reducing the size from 2-inch to 1-inch or greater. How do they go about deciding this, or do you know anything about that? Or
yeah, again, some of this is based on kind of the best available evidence, and so our current recommendations is, you know, ideally using straps that are 3/4 inch to 1.5 inches wide. The 2-inch, you know, virtually none of the manufacturers that I was aware of were making straps quite that wide, and we, based on the anecdotal evidence that exists, there hasn't been demonstrated that there's enough benefit out of going from a 3/4 inch or a 1 or 1.5 all the way to a 2-inch that it would make it so much more tree friendly, so to speak. You know, the recommendation though is we recommend that folks avoid anything thinner than a 3/4 inch strap. And you know, what I encourage hammock campers to do is look at the tree before you go to bed. When you hang your hammock for the evening, take a look at the bark the next morning and see if there's any noticeable impact. One of the ways that we've documented some of these impacts is just through the simple photographs. There are some very high-tech devices that can measure cambium depth, bark compression, and that sort of thing. As you might imagine, these are expensive devices. But I would say even hammock campers can monitor their own potential impact and start to catalog what species might be more susceptible. I can think of a number of trees, having a forestry degree and natural resources degree, I can think of some trees that may be more susceptible just by the very act of having a strap, where other trees, you probably would never be able to tell if someone hammock camped on that tree. So, you know, there's just some awareness involved in it as well in terms of thinking about how to minimize those impacts.
Very cool. Thank you. I've actually noticed even some trees that I thought would be very durable, but they have like moss or something like that, and you can actually see that the straps were there, even though it may not have harmed the tree.
Exactly. One of the things that to consider as well is most of the impacts that we're dealing with in the outdoors are cumulative over time, and impacts can occur at very low levels of use. And so when a visitor comes into an area, let's say a hammock camper comes into an area and plans on hammock camping, and there may be a few trees that have some, you could tell based on the moss, for example, that, wow, it looks like somebody hung a hammock here. But that's just kind of how it is. And this is the first time I've been here. It's still beautiful. And I guess I'll hang my hammock here too, because clearly someone's done it before. And then subsequent people come in, and as the impact increases, unless you're a repeat visitor, when you show up there, the situation that you see is just what you think the situation is, and you have no frame of reference that it has changed over time based on these accumulating impacts. So I think one of the issues that we deal with at Leave No Trace is trying to get folks to realize that even though your visit is just a snapshot in time, all of our impact is cumulative. It's individual, but it's also cumulative over time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, one of our earlier guests, Dutch, who actually did hike the AT when he was much younger, and he did that in a hammock himself, he had made a comment about how intensively used a lot of the formal campsites on the AT were used, and he actually suggested that the use of hammocks could lead to the use of the distribution of more dispersed camping, essentially what we'd call stealth camping, right? Maybe some land management doesn't necessarily approve of it, but the idea that because the impact is so low, you could actually spread your camping out a lot farther. But I'm not sure how that fits into either land management or fits into kind of the Leave No Trace ideals of trying to preserve the or retain the camping in the same area.
Yeah, the concept of sort of stealth camping and utilizing hammocks to basically spread the impact, there's actually sort of some terminology for that. With land management, we talk about we can either have a dispersal strategy where we tell folks to camp far and wide and not use the same site. So maybe you spend one night at a site and people don't use it for a year or two and it fully recovers and maybe even quicker. And then we get to a point where dispersal doesn't work and we move to a containment strategy. So here is the developed site where you need to camp tonight. And so in the case of the AT, I would agree with that notion that hammocks do open up much more area to camping away from what are arguably overused or very heavily used sites. Now, obviously, people need to check with land management agencies. So, for example, the USDA Forest Service lands, in many cases, you are allowed to camp where you would like, and that would include hammock camping, provided you follow their local rules and regs, and things like staying away from water sources and that sort of thing. In places like national parks, for example, like Great Smoky Mountains National Park, there are tighter regulations on where you can camp and where you cannot camp. So it's really a matter of being mindful of the rules and regs in a particular area. But I do agree that hammocks open up a lot more area to minimum impact dispersed camping, particularly if you're only going to stay there one night and you're well off trail, and the chances of someone else finding and or utilizing that same site, or heaven forbid, those exact same trees, I would argue that's a very low probability. And so I do think that there are some advantages to being able to more adequately disperse our camping activities, particularly for the hammock campers, given their minimal impact to begin with.
Now, with teaching, you know, people come to you, they come to the Leave No Trace organization, and they go to learn how to be respectful of the environment. As everyday hikers, campers, whatever we're doing out in the woods, how do you approach a stranger that, you know, without being a pushy know-it-all hiker, to educate them on Leave No Trace principles?
Excellent question. That's a question that we routinely get is, hey, I care about a place. I know a little bit or maybe a lot about Leave No Trace. How do I convey that to someone who I see doing something that's creating impact that I know could be minimized or even avoided altogether? And there are a couple of ideas to consider here. So the first and foremost, what I tell people after being in this business for a long time is pick your battles. Really think about the situations where you feel like you can move the needle and make a difference versus situations that might be doomed to fail from the start. And so with that concept in mind, it's important for people to know that when you're talking about dealing with impacts to resources, public lands, shared lands, there are really kind of two, I'll call them phases of knowledge, if you will, that people need to have in order to make a change to their behavior. And the whole issue of behavior change is vast, but I'll distill it down to these two. Number one is people need a basic understanding of the natural world around them. And in some cases, I mean very basic, that this spring right here, right off the Appalachian Trail, eventually flows down the hill and goes into that creek that goes into that river that goes into your water source in town. And so if you put your human waste in this spring, if that happened repeatedly over time, we could potentially have an impact on the water source. So people need a basic understanding of the natural world around them. And they also need an understanding of the consequences of their actions. When people understand the world around them and have an understanding of those consequences, it's oftentimes easier for them to accept good, solid information on how they can go about minimizing their impacts. And so what I encourage people to do, and actually there's a technique for this. If folks are interested in it, you can just simply Google it, but it's called the authority of the resource technique. And it's been routinely used for many years by certainly federal land management agencies, notably rangers. And this authority of the resource technique posits that in many cases, an agency will talk about the authority of the agency. So they see someone doing something that's causing impact, and it's right to the ticket book. You know, if you do that, I'm going to write you a ticket. And what this authority of the resource technique posits is that wild nature also has its own authority. You know, an authority, the textbook definition is it's the ability to influence thought or opinion or behavior. And so I think most of us that spend time in the outdoors would agree that nature in and of itself can influence the way I think or the way I behave. And so this technique has three steps. And the first step is that if you see somebody doing something, and I never use the terms right and wrong with Leave No Trace. I use the terms there's great Leave No Trace practices and there's things that are maybe less than Leave No Trace. And so if you see somebody doing something that's less than Leave No Trace, an example would be they're washing dishes with soap in the water source. And the authority of the resource says the first thing you want to do is make an objective statement about what you see. And the objective piece is critical because you don't want to make a subjective statement and put somebody, you know, sort of go ahead and create tension right off the bat. So it's an objective statement. Hey, looks like you had a great meal. I see you're doing your dishes. And you say, yeah, I'm doing my dishes right here. Objective statement. Second piece is tell them about the consequences of their actions. And that's where you say, you know, have you camped here before? No, I've never been here before. Well, I have. This is such a wonderful place. You know, this is actually the only water source for the next 4 miles. And it's a fairly heavily used area. And, you know, so many people are here. And there's lots of wildlife here, obviously, that uses water source as well. And so, you know, soap in the water can really kind of cause some problems here. So that's the consequences. And the third piece is tell them how they can either change their actions or give them an alternative. And that can be as simple as, hey, you know what? I've got a collapsible bucket. I'm happy to collect some water from here and I'll walk. I can show you, we can walk away from this water source and I can show you how I clean my dishes. And it's very easy. It's very sanitary and I protect a water source for me and you and all the next visitors here. So this three-step process of making an objective statement, of talking about the consequences of the actions and then giving them suggestions, tips, ideas on how to address that, that's been a tried and true proven method. So again, I'll go back to my original statement of pick your battles, you know, put yourself in someone else's shoes. You know, it may be the first time they've been out in the woods for a month or first time in a year or first time ever. And so having some empathy and some compassion, you know, put your educator hat on and really do your best to give them some information, make them feel good about being in the outdoors. Don't come across as preachy or dogmatic. And if it's a situation that really gets under your skin, those may be the best ones to avoid because the approach that you take, the attitude you have, whether you have a smile on your face or not, those all factor into how that interaction will play out. And so being mindful of the things that you feel like you can make a difference when addressing versus the things that, boy, it just really frustrates me to no end and I'm just going to walk away from this one. So those are a few tips. There's a lot more information that's out there in terms of effective education. But for most casual outdoor enthusiasts, I think – thinking about your approach, being empathetic, and trying to give them real suggestions that They may not put into action now, but you're planting a seed for later. That's kind of the mindset you've got to take.
Wow. Something tells me you are really, really awesome at Thanksgiving dinner.
You know, I think it depends on who's sitting at the table.
Either really fun or really quiet.
Yeah. There's, you know, I mean, this whole notion of Leave No Trace and the idea of targeting people's specific attitudes about the outdoors and taking care of the outdoors and ultimately influencing how people interact with the outdoors. When you say things like changing behavior, it has a very big brother context and connotation. The outdoors are really a place for freedom. And that's something that we never want to do is limit people's freedom in the outdoors. What we want to do is help people take care of these places so that they can go there for the rest of their lives and their kids and their grandkids can continue to enjoy these same places. Because listen, let's face it, we're not making more land. We're always making more people.
True enough. Speaking of freedom, I'm sure you've seen a lot of the controversy that's come up in the recent year or two about using hammocks in urban areas. Especially you've seen universities coming down pretty hard on hammockers. It's not hammock camping per se, but there seems to be two really well-divided camps around using hammocks in urban settings.
Yeah, I would agree. The use of urban hammocks, whether it's college campuses, which is clearly a hotbed, or urban municipal parks is another area where we're hearing about this. Places like Charleston, South Carolina, or San Francisco, where land management agencies, those municipal land management agencies, have deemed it to be an activity that's incompatible with, you know, the continued use, enjoyment, protection of these lands they manage. And being a good partner to federal, state, and local land managers, we default to their rules and regulations. That doesn't mean that we as an organization don't encourage them to make data-driven decisions. And given the absence of real firm data on the real impacts of hammock use, whether it's overnight or day use, my feeling is that there's probably room for discussion and some collaborative decision making on what the potential downside and what the potential upside to the use of hammocks is until we do have that definitive data that says, hey, this is not harmful, or hey, it's harmful if done this way, or, you know, regardless, when we figure out the true data points that can really help direct those decisions, I think that we're going to make ultimately collectively better decisions. So it's a challenging issue. There's no question about it. And, I encourage hammock users, whether you're a camper or a day user or both, to go talk to your local land manager if it's a state or municipal land manager that is either limiting hammock use or outright banned hammock use. Walk in there with some Leave No Trace information and have an open and friendly dialogue with them about it. And for those of you that are listening to this saying, well, I've tried that, it doesn't work. You don't sharpen a knife with one pass over the stone. It takes multiple passes. And I would encourage you to keep the conversation going, keep the dialogue going, look for municipalities out there that are allowing it and find out why they're allowing it. And use that in your argument to say, hey, we can do this sustainably here and we can do it the right way. And I'll mention this, it's a bit of a side tangent, but hammock users are not the only ones that are being singled out, if you will, for lack of a better word, in terms of connecting things to trees. People that like to slackline, sort of the climbing community.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Started it. Slackliners have been lumped in with this as well because they're connecting straps to trees and they're under tension. And so there may be ways to align yourself with other like-minded outdoor enthusiasts to build a bit of a stronger coalition, not so much to fight, but to come to the table with ideas and suggestions and dialogue. That would be my suggestion because it is tricky. And when you have an outright ban on an activity, it feels like the door is not open for people to walk in and say, let's have a conversation about this. But I have found there's always ways to get that door to open. You catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. So I think that walking in there with an open mind and conveying your points articulately and in a way that says we care about this place and we want to enjoy it in a way that's sustainable. Let's figure out ways that we can all enjoy it sustainably. Most managers in my experience tend to view that sort of take very favorably. And I think that can help where access is being limited.
Yeah, there's that sounds a lot like a lot of the successes that we've seen in the Pacific Northwest with some of the mountain biking associations.
When we see groups really come together and proactively look for solutions and really come at it from more of that less adversarial, more we care about this place, and maybe even more with a stewardship or a service mindset, that opens a lot of doors when people come and say, we're willing to help solve other problems here, whether that's directed specifically at our activity or other things that are causing impacts or issues for you. We're here to help because we care about and want to continue to enjoy this place. And that just speaks volumes to managers when people are willing to put their shoulder to the wheel to be part of the solution for whatever the issues may be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's what's the connection between the Leave No Trace, treading lightly, and just general outdoor ethics?
The connection between these various outdoor ethic types programs is fairly interesting. So as I mentioned earlier, Leave No Trace has this history dating back to the passage of the Wilderness Act, and really the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics, in many ways, we were a sort of spinoff of the USDA Forest Service. We've been our own 501c3 nonprofit since 1994. But the idea, the genesis of it, in some ways came out of the USDA Forest Service in partnership with the National Park Service Bureau of Land Management. And so we've been this nonprofit now based in Colorado for over 20 years. And what we have seen over time is the evolution of these outdoor ethics programs, one of those being a program known as Tread Lightly. And Tread Lightly also was a spinoff of the federal agencies. Tread Lightly actually predated Leave No Trace as an organization. And the specific focus for Tread Lightly is really on motorized use. ATVs, OHVs, off-highway vehicles, personal watercraft, motorcycles, Jeep use, those sorts of things. And it's really an effort to reach that sort of motorized outdoor community with good outdoor ethics information, skills, and techniques to minimize their impact when they're enjoying the outdoors legally with motorized vehicles, which is a great way to enjoy the outdoors where it's allowed. And so Tread Lightly and Leave No Trace, oftentimes I like to think of it as we're working in tandem. You know, we focus on non-motorized use, that's including mechanized use like mountain bikes, but we focus on non-motorized. I used to say we focus on human-powered use, but the equestrian community said, nope, not all human-powered use here. You got to count us in. And so we focus on kind of non-motorized and some mechanized use. Tread Lightly really focused on the motorized piece. And then this sort of broader general notion of outdoor ethics, I would like to think in some ways is kind of the umbrella for both of those organizations. It's really this idea about being stewards of the places that we care about, doing what we can individually to take care of these places.
Any idea why the BSA has moved from the Leave No Trace to the Outdoor Code? It seems like there's been a change there in the past year or two.
There has been. And as a scouter for many, many years, and in my daily job with Leave No Trace, I'm constantly in contact with Boy Scouts at all levels, national councils, districts, even down to the unit level. And what's interesting with the Scouts, and I certainly applaud their efforts. I would say that as a single organization in the U.S., there's been no other single entity that has integrated and done as much with Leave No Trace in the last decade as the Boy Scouts of America. They have fully integrated Leave No Trace into everything that they're doing. Their rank system, in fact, you cannot earn second class now if you don't learn about Leave No Trace. If you don't earn second class, you'll never earn Eagle. So they've done so much to integrate it. It's really the core and the roots of scouting. You go back to Baden-Powell, Leave No Trace, the concept of Leave No Trace is always there. And Scouts has really, BSA has really reinvigorated that. Over the last couple of years, they have gone to more of the outdoor ethics program model, which has elements of Leave No Trace as well as elements of Tread Lightly. That was very strategically done because some scouting properties brought in motorized use, personal watercraft, ATVs, and those sorts of things. And the Scouts felt the need to provide outdoor ethics information for those Scout units or Scout properties where those activities were being engaged in using motorized vehicles and that kind of thing, or ATVs. And so it was a logical extension of we're utilizing Leave No Trace for the majority of what scouting does because most of it is non-motorized, but look, we've got this motorized element. Let's bring in Tread Lightly and let's house it all under this umbrella of outdoor ethics. And so, I applaud the Scout's effort to be as comprehensive as possible in educating young people about minimizing their impacts in the outdoors.
Cool. Do you work with a lot of or youth organizations, or is it primarily with scouting? And
we do work with a variety of youth organizations. In fact, we have a very active, what we call Leave No Trace Community Partner Program. And our community partners, there's about 600 community partners. These are colleges, universities, outfitter and guide services, small businesses, nonprofit entities, youth serving organizations. And these are entities that we know through our own research internally when we look at our community partner outreach. Through formal Leave No Trace education, each community partner that we have reaches about 1,100 people a year formally. So that's some sort of training or a class. Through more non-formal means, we're in the millions. But what we know is through formal trainings, we're reaching 500,000-600,000 people a year through these community partners. Many of those are youth-serving organizations, YMCA, American Camp Association camps. We have a number of summer camp type partners. We work with entities in some cases like 4-H. So we have a very specific focus on youth. The scouting is Boy Scouts in particular is a big piece of that. But we also work with the Girl Scouts of the USA. And so we have really tried to be a very inclusive with not only all outdoor enthusiasts, but all different types of youth and youth serving organizations. Because obviously, you know, youth are the future. And as a parent, I see it every day. And so we have a very robust youth program. In fact, we have a multi-year initiative that we launched in 2015 called Leave No Trace for Every Kid. Hmm. And that's really an effort to get Leave No Trace in the hands of, make it accessible for and relevant for every kid in the country who spends any amount of time outside.
Okay, great. Well, last question about Leave No Trace and hammock camping. If I wanted to work with a local land management organization or land resource management organization, is there a way that I can get Leave No Trace involved more formally than just kind of saying, you know, hey, look, Leave No Trace suggests that hammock camping is safe for trees and for the land?
Definitely. We, the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics, have been under what's called a Memorandum of Understanding with the National Park Service, the USDA Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Army Corps of Engineers since 1994. So we have a formal arrangement with those five federal land management agencies that Leave No Trace is their minimum impact program. We also have another Memorandum of Understanding with the National Association of State Park Directors, the NASPD. And so that links us with all 50 state park systems. And we have dozens and dozens of municipal partners around the country. So if you're in an area and you would like to bring Leave No Trace information for hammock camping or hammock use to that area in a more formal way, we can help you do that through those partnerships, particularly if it's federal or state land. And even in the absence of a partnership, we're happy to work with land managers across the agency spectrum to provide them the best information that we have. And all of our information is science-based, and it is vetted through a process. We've got a review and research network that looks at not only all of our curriculum and information, but also all of our research and studies and integrates the best of the newest findings into what we're doing. We want to be on the cutting edge of these techniques and skills for minimizing impact. So if folks are in an area where Leave No Trace is non-existent, whether it's for hammock use or not, or any other use, feel free to reach out to the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics. Our website is lnt.org. We would be glad to help you get information to the hands of those individuals, or we can work directly with those individuals where those relationships exist. So we are actively seeking new opportunities to work with both individuals as well as communities and land management agencies. And that's really what the whole purpose of our organization is, to get as much of this information out to the broadest possible audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I know anecdotally, we see from time to time people complaining that a local park ranger will look at the hammock as something that's being hung from a tree. And certainly I'm sure you'd agree that's probably not the time to argue the point, but being able to circle back, especially if you've ended up having to spend your night on the ground and weren't expecting it, being able to circle back and actually say, hey, this is something that we'd like to start doing, and we'd like to see if your organization or your park can start supporting it. Having a set of resources to work with is going to be helpful. So oftentimes that voice in the wilderness is challenging.
It is challenging indeed. And to be able to walk in the door with Leave No Trace in hand, it can be a great way to start that conversation. Because it, in many ways, to a lot of land managers says, hey, this person's given this some thought, or this group has given this some thought, and they're already thinking about minimizing their impact in this way. Again, regardless of how you choose to spend time in the outdoors, but specifically for hammock use. And it is emerging, particularly when you look at the retail sector and the trends in just the number of hammocks that are being sold. It's amazing. It's amazing growth, which is a very cool thing. It's getting a lot of people outdoors. And so that's, there's a lot of good in that, but it's also a huge opportunity for us to collectively do what we can to promote and ensure sustainability of these shared resources that we have.
Yeah, you know, last week we were talking, or last week, last month, I'm sure a lot of our listeners would love us to be weekly, but last month we talked to the guys from Yukon Hammocks. They said they were actually trying to start some kind of an association of hammock manufacturers to try to push a little bit harder on having a set of standards in terms of how hammocks are manufactured, how they're tested for quality. And one of the big things they want to really push is asking each of the hammock manufacturers to require or by default include the tree stapes or the tree savers with their product. Is that something you guys are involved with as well? Or
We are not yet involved with the group or this emerging group that you mentioned, but we certainly have a number of industry partners that are hammock manufacturers. And there has been a tremendous amount of interest from them in continuing to promote best practices, sustainable practices, and also looking at some standardization across the manufacturing spectrum so that every hammock does come with, you know, a standard set of tree saver straps. And that, you know, for example, every hammock that you buy has got, let's say, the leave no trace information is included with those hammocks. That would be a great thing. And I think it would go a long way towards alleviating some of the concerns that may be out there from a variety of sectors in terms of this emerging use. And so I would welcome that, and we would love to participate in something along those lines. And given our relationships with, you know, various management agencies across the country, we might be a natural fit to help inform that work. And if we, depending on how what's developed and what comes out of an effort like that, we, the Leave No Trace Center, can help promote that sort of thing, which we routinely do with other segments of the outdoor industry where standards have been developed for equipment that's built to minimize impact.
Very cool.
So now usually we like to end with a little off-topic discussion, and I'll usually start off, and today we're going to talk about basically, do you bring a knife into the woods? We're not talking, you know, I'm worried about what's behind that next tree as I'm walking up the trail or anything, but, you know, when I'm out, actually, I have a Swiss Army knife that was given to me actually when I got my Eagle. It's from the Wilco, the old Long Island Lighting Company, and I've been carrying that thing around for 20 some odd years now. And at every trip it's on, it's not the lightest, but you know, it's got all the little tools and everything on it.
Yes, I have to admit, I always have a knife on me, particularly in the woods. And I too have my original Victorinox Swiss Army knife from when I was a scout. I still have the leather sheath. My father took me to a local gear shop in Nashville, Tennessee, called the Pack Rat. This was been in the early 80s, and got to pick out the Swiss Army knife. I still have the tweezers and the toothpick after all these years.
Wow.
I managed to keep up with those things. And
do you still use the toothpick?
The toothpick has been retired for it's just more sentimental value now, but I do carry a knife. You know, it's hard to not, once a scout, always a scout. It's hard to not follow that be prepared motto. And so I definitely carry a Swiss Army knife still with me. And being a river runner, I'm not, you know, I don't worry about the weight as much. When I pack my backpack, I might choose a lighter tool for the job, but it's one of those pieces of gear that was just instilled in me as a kid in scouting, that it's just rather have it and not need it than, you know, not have it and need it.
Yeah.
Actually, now that you mention it, that you still have your tweezers and toothpick, when we record, I'm down in my basement and one of my gear boxes just happened to be close by, so I grabbed it. And I do have my tweezers. However, the toothpick is missing.
Sadly, it's missing.
Yes. So.
Well, but you've got the tweezers. That they were far more useful than the toothpick ever was.
Yep. Yep. Now, actually, when now you seem about the same age as us, growing up in the 80s and all. When you were younger in Scouts, did you want one of those Rambo survival knives?
Without question.
My dad never would let me get one.
I must admit, I had one. It was not as large as I would have liked, but I I had a fixed blade that was very reminiscent of Rambo. It probably had a 6-inch fixed blade, which was certainly big enough, but it did have the hollow handle with the fishing line, the needles, the, you know, two waterproof matches. It had the stuff, and oh, I loved that thing, and it was such a cheap piece of junk, but it was just so exciting. When I was probably in my early teens when I finally, I think, convinced my parents that I was ready for a Rambo survival knife.
Yes.
Yes.
Jonathan, how about you?
Well, I don't actually have my Swiss Army knife that I got when I was a kid. I wasn't in the Scouts, I'm afraid. But when my son moved up to from Weeblos to Boy Scouts, I gave him the Swiss Army knife that I had had when I was a boy. So I've already parted with it. And he's managed to lose it and then find it again, thank goodness. and he hasn't managed to lose it since then. So he still has that, and I'm hoping that he keeps that as something that he's a little more sentimental about. I don't have one normally in my pocket. Just I travel enough that I've had a couple of knives taken away from me. So I keep a little, there's a little pocket knife that you can keep on your keychain. It looks like a key. And sometimes I'll just have that in my pocket for most of the time. But I do have a little Leatherman style. It's very small. It's got most of the tools. But it pretty much as light as I can. I don't carry a Bowie knife or anything like that with me when I'm out backpacking. I've thought about it, but the only thing I can think of needing a big knife for is like rendering wood down and stuff like that, and I just can't get around to liking campfires. I'm one of those people that doesn't like the smell of creosote on all of my stuff when I come out from the backcountry. I end up having to air everything out for a couple of days to get that odor out of everything. So I'm not a big fan of campfire, so I just need a knife and a tool, you know, to open up, you know, a bag of food or whatever. Don't really have a big need for it. Well, Ben, we really wanted to say thank you so much for joining us and for giving us some of your time. I understand this is a little bit after work for you, so I appreciate that.
Well, thanks you both for the opportunity. Anytime I have the opportunity to talk to people about Leave No Trace, it's a great thing, because the hope is that it resonates with folks and that they realize that it's not onerous, it's not hard. It can make for a lighter pack, a safer trip. It can make things easier. You take a lot of the guesswork out of spending time in the outdoors. And so I very much appreciate the opportunity. And I would encourage any of your listeners who have questions to visit our website. There's a lot of great information on our website. And if they would like to go in more depth and look at some of the more specific resources, feel free to contact me. I'm happy to help in any way I can, and look forward to hopefully hearing from folks in the hammock camping and hammock use community to really spread this word, spread the information, spread the techniques and skills, so that we can all continue to enjoy these shared places responsibly.
Awesome. Thank you. Anything else you'd like to share?
So clearly we've spent some time talking about the sort of camping impacts associated with hammock use. But one thing that, you know, I'd love for your listeners to be mindful of is that there are other ways that all outdoor users can affect the backcountry or even the front country. So it's important to think about how we're going to deal with all of our trash, litter, our gray water, so when we wash our dishes or brush our teeth, and also thinking about what we're going to do with our human waste, using provided facilities, digging what we call a cat hole, you know, a 6 to 8 inch deep hole that's 200 feet from a water source, People always ask me, what's the diameter? And I laughingly say, it depends on your aim. But generally, we advocate about a 4-inch diameter. That's usually big enough. And another question we get with that is, do I need to pack out my toilet paper? Some of our recent studies on toilet paper decomposition are showing that it's perfectly acceptable to bury the toilet paper deeply in the cat hole. So you don't need to necessarily pack that out unless it's required by a land manager. So thinking about how you're going to deal with all manner of waste, trash, litter, gray water, your human waste, and also thinking about things like campfire impacts. If you choose to have a fire, no problem, provided it's allowed, the conditions are safe, you've got the skills and know-how, there's plenty of wood around. Being mindful of campfires and keeping a relatively, not necessarily small, but a reasonable campfire. We encourage folks to use wood no bigger than their wrist, wood you find that's down, that's dead, not breaking branches off trees or cutting down live trees. Also thinking about how you're going to properly store your food and in many cases your trash from wildlife, whether that's the use of a bear canister or hanging your food. Depends on the environment that you're in and depends on what your local critters are. But thinking about keeping food away from wildlife, if it's not part of their normal diet, it's something that we should make sure they don't get into. And then lastly, I'd say thinking about the other visitors that are out there. And being mindful that there are millions and millions of us trying to enjoy what I call a finite resource. The National Park Service alone hosts about 300 million visitors per year. When you look at state parks in the United States, there are over 7,000 state parks in the U.S. with an annual visitation of over 740 million. So we're talking lots of people in the U.S. visiting parks lots and lots of times throughout the year. And the point is, we all need to do what we can to get along with everyone else that's out there trying to share this finite resources. So thinking about your camping impacts is certainly important, but thinking about the other seven principles of Leave No Trace and doing what you can to minimize those individual but cumulative impacts is always a good thing. It's always in style.
That's awesome. Thank you very much. So you know what I saw in the forums the other day, Mark?
Yes.
Was a really interesting thread somebody had picked up on doing insulation with milkweed pods. Have you ever heard of that?
I have just recently, as opposed to using down for your insulation, which they, if I remember reading, they used for the first time World War II, I believe.
Yeah, I think they use them for life vests or something like that.
Yes.
And I actually remembered having seen an article about it. I read Gizmodo. It's like a tech geek website, blog site or whatever. And I remembered having seen an article about that, about how the milkweed pods, when you open them up, you get all the fuzzy stuff from the milkweeds and how conceivably this could be harvested and used completely independently of down for the same or very similar insulating outcome for a very similar weight.
Right. So, and it's supposed to be, it's natural. It's basically a weed.
Yeah.
Grows everywhere. And, instead of having to harvest down from the ducks and geese, which, if they're not being, it's not a pretty sight seeing that happen, so.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it is there, with the decrease in goose consumption, especially in China,
right.
There's a drop in the availability of down via what you might consider an ethical source, right? Because that's raising geese for meat, I guess, is ethical. I've never seen them raising it, so I don't know how ethical that is, but I would think that stripping down off of a live goose that you don't intend to eat would be less ethical.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like something I'd want to endure.
Yeah.
But it's definitely and something that you can just, basically almost find in the side of the road looking. It seems like they grow not in wet areas, not completely submerged by water, but along the perimeters.
Mm-hmm.
You can, just getting on the side of the road and boy, it'd be nice to be able to do. Just be able to do that. Just think of all the underquilts we can make.
Yeah, that would be a challenge. well, I think they're called the ovum, the milkweed ovum, which is the part of the plant that contains all the seeds. So I think the biggest part of the problem is that you have to break open the ovum, and then you have to strip out all the seeds, which is really time-consuming to do it manually. Mm-hmm. And then you need to dry and fluff all of the milkweed floaties, the insulating portion of it. I actually saw there's a company in Quebec that is making a go at using milkweed for insulation instead of down. It looks like it's a similar price. I didn't do the conversion, so it's probably a little cheaper, but anecdotally, it looks like, you know, pure milkweed used as insulation is just as warm or warmer than down.
Yeah, I've seen a couple different things. One place I did see that it was to, if you're using it for insulation, to mix it with 50-50 mix of down and the milkweed.
Okay.
So, you know, it's still something that's something new and how they can economically harvest it and all. But
you know, maybe it would be worth it to find some and make some milkweed slippers for the winter, some fluffy slippers. That might be enough, or little enough, that I could tolerate the work.
Yeah, the socks for sleeping out, or you know, for the cold nights camping.
Yeah, the booties, like instead of the down or Apex booties, make some milkweed booties.
There you go.
That'd be fun.
There you go. Yeah.
Now I just have to figure out where they grow. I could probably throw some seeds in the backyard and hope that my wife doesn't tell me off for having weeds in the yard.
I did see, well, you know, another benefit there, do help the monarch butterfly.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Population.
That's a natural food source for them, right?
Yes. So that's, you just, you know, just say, hey, I'm just thinking of the butterflies.
There you go. That's perfect. Well. I would love to hear from any of our listeners, and if any of our listeners are trying to play with milkweed pods and want to write in or share something about it, we'll read it on our next episode in our listener comments, because I'm curious to know how easy or hard it is to do it and how productive it is as a source of insulation. So hopefully we'll hear something from someone. Next month, we're actually going to be talking to a couple of folks from the Palmetto State Hangers. Do you know what the Palmetto State Hangers are? Have you heard of them?
A little bit. Hanging group, right?
Mm-hmm. Down in the Carolinas. I think South Carolina is the Palmetto State.
Yep, that's where I saw it. Did some looking up on them.
And we're going to get a couple of the founding members, Gresh and Junebug, from the Palmetto State Hangers. They're a couple of the organizers, and they're going to tell us how to start a hanging club and how to make this kind of thing work.
Yeah, it should be an interesting interview.
I think it'll be fun.
All right. Now to get to some of our listeners' comments and see what other people have to say.
Mm-hmm.
We have from the forums from Lat. He says, enjoyed the episode. After I crunched through the first 13 episodes during the first 2 weeks of last month, I've missed them. Now I miss them again. How's the bi-monthly plans coming along?
Well, I'd love to do bi-monthly.
Yep.
And that's why we have the Patreon campaign. I'd like to see. I'd love to see more patrons supporting what we're doing. I can see how many people are actually downloading. It's probably more than 10.
Yeah. We've got our cup of coffee.
Yeah. So thanks to you that are supporting us, but if you're not supporting us, this would be a good time to drop what you're doing and go buy us a cup of coffee or whatever. Regardless, Lat, thanks a lot for the compliment, and I know you're looking forward to episode 16 when that comes out.
Yep. Then going along, we have from Joe, I can't wait for new episodes. I have recently purchased 2 hammocks since I have started listening to the show. I also got my wife and daughter on board with hammock camping. Thanks.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really getting on there. Got wife and kid on there.
I'd like to see you get your wife and daughter on board, dude.
Yeah, that's funny. yeah, that's getting my wife outside is not enough right there.
Well, I'm sure she's listening.
Yeah. And then finally from Evan on Facebook, I love the podcast. Thanks for producing such an enjoyable show about hammocking and hammock camping. I've really enjoyed taking my hammock life to the next level.
Cool. Well, thanks, Evan. I'm glad we were able to help you out.
Yeah, thanks for the comments.
Yeah. So great comments, everyone. Keep it coming, either iTunes or through our social media. We love to hear those comments. And if you've got anything to add to what we're doing or just want to share your kudos, we'd love to hear them. Thank you very much.
And that's the show for this month. As always, you can find us at www.hyohpodcast.com or on our Facebook page at HYOH Podcast. If you like what you hear, please give us a positive review on iTunes. Or even better, you can join our growing team of Patreon sponsors.
That's right, Mark. If we hit our Patreon goal, we're going to go bi-monthly. Imagine interviewing two cool hammock campers every month. It's been the number one request in our social connections from our listeners. If you want to donate monthly, you can also find a link to the Patreon campaign on our website homepage. Or if you'd prefer, you could buy us a cup of coffee by going directly to www.hyohpodcast.com/donate and simply make a one-time donation. Christmas is close, Mark, and I'm sure that our listeners are thinking about what they might want to get for the special people in their lives. But it's not too late to order Yukon Outfitters Wildfire Top Quilt or Kindle Bottom Quilts and try hammock camping in the cooler months this year. Or maybe a full hammock hanging kit, including one of Yukon's hammocks, a walkabout tarp, and a no-fly zone bug net. And as a special offer for our listeners, Yukon has given us a special 25% off promo code to use when making their Christmas purchases, HYOH16.
That's pretty generous, especially for a quality hammock made in America. So right now, go to yukonoutfitters.com, that's yukon-outfitters.com, and be sure to use the promo code HYOH16 when taking care of that holiday shopping.
And while rounding out the old holiday shopping, go to hotehammock.com and check out some of their new designs, including hammock coffee, or an old classic, Hooked on Dutchware. I'm sure that anyone who loves hanging in their hammock would love to wear one, and since Hote Hammocks are one of our episode sponsors, our listeners can use the discount code HYOH15 in the shopping cart when they go to hotehammock.com and purchase a few hammock t-shirts for Christmas. That's HAUTEHammock.com.
Since we're thanking our sponsors, we should also acknowledge some of those folks who have become patrons or donated to our show. Thanks much this month to Michael Gudzwitz, who said, "Thanks for an informative and entertaining podcast. Keep up the good work. Enjoy the holidays, fellas." Thanks a lot, Mike. You too. As always, if you want to comment or have a question, please visit our Facebook page. Or you can send me an email at mark@hyohpodcast.com.
And me at jonathan@hyohpodcast.com. Finally, special thanks to Skid Von Ark for allowing us to use his music for both our intro and our outro, and to ITX for hosting our podcast. Thanks everyone for hanging around. Open my eyes, and what did I see? A man from Minnesota swinging tree to tree. A thin piece of fabric suspended in the air. Should I even try it, or should you even dare? Had two straps and a couple of toggles. How this would even work, my mind began to boggle. Yeah.